Well, I was when I started reading Significant Others, I understood that these were stories from that had appeared as a newspaper column. Is that correct?
Yes, they started out originally in the San Francisco Chronicle in 1976, and there have been five installments total. They last about 6 months in the newspaper, roughly 120 episodes, which are then sewn together and rewritten for the book versions.
Well, as I began reading, I had thought, well, these are short stories, and usually when I approach a book of short stories or even a book of poetry, I start in the middle someplace, so I open up and I began reading. Each one holds up as individual stories, but as I flipped through, I began seeing that the same characters appeared, and there were references to others, so I realized I had to start at the beginning. So I went back, and I started at the beginning, and I said, hey, this is a novel. This isn't just a collection of short stories. So I was puzzled. How do you make this a serial? In effect, it's a serial, isn't it, in the newspaper?
Well, I've trained myself over the years to write for both the serial form and the novel that I know that is going to result from the serial. So it's just a question of understanding how it's going to end up ultimately. I try to keep it interesting and internally interesting for the day-to-day reader, although there's less of that than there was in the early days before I even knew that they would be novels.
Of course, there's an old tradition that even Dickens wrote in parts.
Yes, there's a very long, honorable tradition of it. I had to remind a lot of my editors of that when I first introduced this at the Chronicle in 76 because they still had an enormous prejudice against fiction appearing in a newspaper. Acknowledged fiction, I should say.
Well, as you began doing these, you had the idea for the entire story blocked out in your mind, obviously, but you hadn't finished writing these as they began to appear in the newspaper.
No, I usually work about a week in advance. I start out about 6 weeks ahead, and then it tends to creep up on me. But that desperation or the deadline, the pressure of deadline, seems to work well for me. I like to work under pressure. Some of my best stories have happened that way.
Well, how much cleaning up did you have to do in order to put this together in a novelized form?
I spent about 6 months rewriting the original copy. The newspaper form is sort of my first draft in public. And because I get a lot of reader response, it helps me to see what I need to do to make the novel really work. I can second-guess people.
I presume also, since there are some relatively explicit scenes in Significant Others, these scenes were not in the newspaper version.
Yeah, some of them weren't. Some of them weren't, and others I've learned to kind of write around it so people know what's going on. But there are none of the forbidden words. It's an interesting thing when you're writing fiction for a newspaper, you're censored in ways that nonfiction writers are not. Nonfiction writers are mostly just are checked for factual errors and for specific words, inclusion of specific words. When you write fiction, the editors seem to reserve to themselves the right to censor you if they think you've conjured up an image in the mind of the reader. If you've even moved the reader in a way that they think might be objectionable, they'll take out a passage.
Well, how did all these stories start? They didn't start in the San Francisco Chronicle, did they?
Yes, they did. Well, I wrote originally for a small Marin County newspaper called the Pacific Sun in 1974 on a weekly basis. And I introduced some of the characters there. But essentially, the stuff that appeared in the Chronicle was the beginning of Tales of the City.
Why is the name changed?
Well, for one thing, I didn't... I've had three novels now called Tales of the City. Tales, More Tales, and Further Tales. So I thought we might be wearing people out and that it would be a good idea to start naming the novels on their own.
But the article or the column that you do for the Chronicle, what is that called?
Well, I do it for the Examiner now.
Oh, the Examiner.
And the last installment was named after the novel it was to become, Significant Others. And the next one I do will be done the same way. I doubt seriously that I'll ever write under the title Tales of the City again in the newspaper because people now know that this is part of the Tales of the City series.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did you manage to make the switch to the Examiner from the Chronicle?
I just left. They were being difficult, essentially, wouldn't deal with my agent, and I would like very much to have stayed. I wasn't demanding any large amounts of money out of them. And as a matter of fact, we had not had even gotten around to discussing the money. It was simply, they're sort of the only game in town, and as the morning newspaper, and are rather arrogant about their position, and didn't seem to me to really care one way or the other whether the serial appeared. And I was receiving a great deal of enthusiasm from Will Hurst, who's the editor of the Examiner, who is frankly a much more liberal and less homophobic editor than the one at the Chronicle. So I walked with no problem at all.
Somehow I see San Francisco is probably one of the few places where a column like yours could be in a major newspaper. Isn't that true? I can't think of anything quite like your series.
Well, it was copied when it first appeared in 76. The following year, it was copied across the country by about seven other metropolitan dailies. Bob Green did one in Chicago for a while that he called Bag Time. There was one in Washington called Federal Triangle. I think there was even one here called Tales of Manhattan or something that I've forgotten who did it now. But it was copied, but I think by and large the spirit was wrong in most of them. They essentially looked at them as spoofs, and I think Tales works because as much fun as I'm having, I'm really quite serious in my affection for these characters, and I think that comes across to the reader.
You are also aiming your stories not at the homosexual community, but to a broad range of people, I would assume.
Oh, of course. I write about gay people, and I think that was one of the things I was proudest of in the beginning, because no one else was. I included gay people in the fabric of life, as they, in fact, do appear. But I was writing for the general audience, and I found not very far into the column that whenever the gay character was beleaguered in some way, that I would get sympathy notes from people who identified themselves. One woman wrote and said, "I'm nothing but a middle-aged housewife from Moraga with two little machos of my own, but if you kill off Michael Mouse, I'll never subscribe to the Chronicle again." So there was genuine affection for the gay characters, and by the same token, gay people were, I made to feel more comfortable about the straight people around them because they saw the ways in which the gay characters interacted with their straight friends. So I like to think of the books and the serials as having built bridges to make people understand each other better.
Well, let's go back. Tell me something about yourself. You're from Raleigh.
I grew up in Raleigh, North Carolina, yeah. Went to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, was supposed to be a lawyer. My father had been a lawyer, and I had to come up with a better offer.
Which was?
Excuse me?
You said you came up with a better offer.
Oh, had not come up with a better offer.
Had not come up with
right.
a better offer.
But I really found, I was president of my freshman law class, but following a long tradition, flunked out, having not attended my equity exam. I was just tired of it, essentially, and hitchhiked home, and this was in the middle of the Vietnam War, so I volunteered for OCS and went to Vietnam as a naval officer.
What was it like growing up in Raleigh?
It was very, pleasant middle-class existence, I guess you could say. It was the same in Raleigh as a gay kid. I presume that's what you mean. It was as hard or as easy as it was anywhere else in the South. I guess even today it's tough for kids who are growing up gay. For me, it was a question of not having any real role models around. There was no one that I could look to that I could say, well, that person is gay and he looks fine. It turns out that that's the way I am, I have nothing to worry about. There were a few horrifying visible examples of homosexuality and not much else because most people were very deeply in the closet. So I guess that's one of the reasons that I travel around a lot today, making it clear who I am and what I'm all about, because I think that children today need to know that if they are feeling homosexual instincts in their teens, as most healthy, sexually active teens do, I mean, they feel sexual instincts of one sort or another, they should know that their lives can be happy and fulfilling, and that there's nothing to be worried about. And That's something that was never told to me as a child, and it makes me very angry sometimes.
But at what point were you consciously aware of being gay? Because it would seem to me there might be a great deal of confusion about the sort of person you might be. I mean, this would be something that would be in anybody's mind, a confusion about what he is or what she is, what she's supposed to do.
Well, I knew I was attracted to my own sex when I was 13 years old. I think much in the way that a 13-year-old boy who's attracted to girls knows that by that age. It was very clear to me, and that as much as I tried to direct my attention towards girls, it just didn't work. It was not there for me. As a consequence, I didn't have sex with anybody until I was 26 years old because I was so afraid of being this terrible thing I was told that I could become. And if there had been somebody there, if there had been some sort of example, I think that life would have been a lot easier.
I was talking to Edmund White a while ago, and I think one of the questions I asked was, why? His response was, why am I gay? He said, I can't explain it, he said. He said, it's a compulsion, and so I've given up trying to analyze it and to explain it. Can you comment on that?
Well, I mean, I might just as well ask you why you're the way you are. I don't know who knows why he is, you know, how he turns out sexually.
Well,
I'm not sure I'd put cult compulsion on it.
Heterosexuality, that is, seems to be the nature of things, and I'm not sure that is that way with homosexuality.
What do you mean, the nature of things?
The nature of our, the way we are, the nature of
it's
our
It's what our culture endorses, what society endorses. Nature is whatever happens. There's homosexuality in amongst animals. There's a natural context for almost everything. I feel perfectly natural. I think people appropriate nature for their own uses. I don't feel unnatural. Put it that way.
At some point, of course, you abandon the pursuit of the law. At some point, I would assume that you wanted to put down on paper your thoughts. You wanted to become a writer. Did you? Your father was a lawyer. Did you have a literary household?
Not really. We had. I sort of grew up in a household of lawyers, judges, military men, sort of old Southern aristocrats with Southern aristocratic jobs. There were very few professions that were really considered acceptable for me. It was sort of doctor, lawyer, a few other things. Writer was really never even discussed until I discovered that I had a talent for it and got more and more interested in it.
Well, tell me about your earliest efforts at writing.
I wrote a bit for the school paper when I was at Chapel Hill. Did some creative writing. Most of my early writing was actually, I mean, professionally, was in journalism. And I found that it was frustrating for me. I couldn't dicker with the facts and make them tell the story that I wanted to tell. So I began to realize that maybe my instincts lay with fiction.
Now, I have a feeling that journalism doesn't coexist well with real writing, having been a journalist for 28 years.
Well, I don't know. I think journalism is marvelous training for a writer. I think a lot of fiction writers should be forced to become journalists because it kind of trims the fat off your prose. You get it down to the bare essentials. And if you like to write the way I do, in a stripped down, spare way, it's very useful. It makes you look for exactly the right word. And I wish a lot more writers would do it. I think that some of these so-called blockbuster novels are just saying the same thing over and over again.
Now, how did you land in San Francisco?
I was offered a job with the AP, with the Associated Press, which brought me there in 1971. And I worked for them for about 5 months. Hated it. It was more grueling than my experience in Vietnam. I really had never been in quite so militaristic an organization as the AP. It was, we were constantly on deadline, for one thing, against the UPI. So it's not like a publication where you can put the magazine or the newspaper to bed. You're always rewriting, always updating. And it was quite grueling for me and boring. And I must admit, I guess not quite enough star quality involved. You know, you don't get your byline isn't visible at the AP for a long, long time. So I got out thinking that I might be able to get a job with one of the local newspapers, very naively, because it was tough. I had to take a lot of little jobs. I was a mail boy. I worked for an Episcopal priest for a while, sold knickknacks in a shop on Union Street, did a lot of things, until I came up with the idea of this serial.
All right, now tell me how you developed the idea for the serial.
Well, it was it grew out of a story I was writing for the Pacific Sun, just a regular nonfiction story, about the Marina Safeway, a big grocery store down on the waterfront in San Francisco, where singles, heterosexual singles, would cruise on Wednesday nights to pick each other up, would essentially push empty shopping carts around and ask each other about the fruits and vegetables. And it was a very popular way for people to meet each other. And I went down there to write a story on it, and I couldn't find anybody who would fess up to what they were actually doing, even though there were some very overdressed people, ladies in kind of rhinestone-studded brushed denim pantsuits, you know, pushing their shopping carts along. So I went home completely frustrated because I had no story and decided, well, I'm just going to make up someone, write a story about it to explain how it works. I made up a single woman named Marianne Singleton. And by the time I got to the end of the story, I decided that what was going to happen was she would meet a number of men that she would find unacceptable. And then when she found one she liked, it was going to turn out that he was there at the grocery store with another man. Because this struck me as a kind of quintessentially a true San Francisco story, because a lot of women at that time were complaining that there were so many gay men that it was hard to find a date. And it struck home with a lot of people. And the editor said, well, what if we follow these people, follow him and follow her and see what happens to them? So I started submitting these articles about where they were going and what they were doing, and the next thing I knew, it had grown into a story.
But the story did develop more and more as a gay series over this.
It had gay characters in it. It's never been defined as a gay series. I've made no bones about my own sexuality. I'm gay. But I don't think it's any more a gay series than Norman Mailer's writing is a heterosexual thing. I really don't apply that to it.
Well, you have a nice, easygoing style. It's funny. As I read Significant Others, there were parts where I could burst out laughing, part where I can't remember all the names of everybody, but the Booter
mm-hmm.
Winds up in the women's camp and is bound and about to be brought to trial, and so there are hilarious parts of it. But underlying these funny parts is this fear of AIDS. Brian, I believe, we don't find out until the last chapter whether or not the test that he underwent was positive. So there is an underlying sense of horror, isn't there, to these stories? Mm.
Yes, very much the way it feels to live life now, especially in San Francisco and New York and other urban centers that are truly plagued with AIDS. And I think eventually the rest of the country, I think it's a sort of warning of things to come, because it's very difficult to live with the idea that your friends could be dead in 2 or 3 years. It's a tough thing. You live in the moment. Every moment becomes precious. The relationships you build with your family of friends becomes the most important thing. And I try to show that in the book. I try to show the way in which these people have drawn closer together in order to nourish themselves with love and to feel some kind of strength against this horrible dread, which, as I point out in the book, is now reaching to straight people as well as to gay people.
Well, I understand that there was so much open homosexuality along the Castro at one point, but that the AIDS crisis has somehow changed the character just visibly. Is that correct?
No, it's not. I live 2 blocks from the Castro. I've heard this story over and over again. The press from all over the world has come to Castro Street looking for some signs of devastation. It's still one of the busiest, most bustling blocks in the city.
I think I got that impression by reading the Francis Fitzgerald book. I think it's called, what is it, City on a Hill, I think.
Cities on a Hill. I don't think Frankie ever actually said that the place had closed down. I think she indicated that people were living their lives in a different way. But that doesn't mean anybody's moved out or that it's devastated. There has been enormous behavior modification. I know people, including myself, who've been practicing safe sex for 5 years now, long before the American press decided to say anything whatsoever about the AIDS epidemic. They were letting people die without even reporting on the fact of it, because, after all, it was just homosexuals. And it was not until Rock Hudson announced his diagnosis that the disease was given any legitimacy whatsoever. And even then, there was so extremely little concern about it until the suggestion, horror of horrors, was passed along that it might not be a gay disease after all. It might be a virus that anyone could get. So I have nothing but pride for San Francisco and my neighborhood in the Castro, because we were literally been taking care of our sick and dying for 5 years now. Have built a whole culture that heterosexuals are now coming to find out what to do in the crisis, and have modified our sexual behavior in a way that I'm sorry to say, will never apply to the heterosexual community. I think there are a lot of heterosexuals who still think of safe sex as kind of a joke, something that doesn't really matter, or it won't really affect them, and I think that's a great tragedy, because we're going to lose more people than we need to.
I have a feeling that you're more than a writer in San Francisco, that somehow you are playing a major role in the gay community as a leader or a spokesman. Tell me about that.
Well, I only speak for myself, really. I think it's dangerous when you say you're speaking for someone else, because you can't really generalize about gay people. We're of every stripe. We're Republicans. We're Democrats. We're old and we're young. We're right-wing and left-wing. We're men and women. It's very, very hard to generalize about homosexuality. So I just try to speak for myself and say, here I am, this is what I'm all about, and I encourage other gay people to do the same.
Did you, were you one of Frances Fitzgerald's hosts when she was doing the research?
Well, she's an old friend of mine, so she came to me right off the bat to sort of, to work on that piece.
I figured that when you referred to her as Frankie.
Right, right.
So you helped to set her up with the interviews, taking her around and the sort of...
Yes, to a certain degree. A man named Ken Maley took her around a great deal, knew what people to fix her up with. It became a sort of joke with us, because originally she was working on it supposedly as a piece for Geo Magazine. And the years wore on, and we said, when is the piece going to appear? And she said, I don't know, I'm rewriting it, I'm doing different things with it. And, you know, she wrote it over an 8-year period, so what she ended up with was really quite an extraordinary history. And I think she did it as well as anybody possibly could have done it, because she was, first of all, she was an outsider, so she came in and she could sort of study these institutions dispassionately. I'm not sure a San Franciscan could have. And she really... untied this Gordian knot in a way that was quite impressive, I felt. It was not condescending towards her subjects, but sort of cast a critical eye when she needed to, but essentially explained the community to the American public for the first time, and opened the way for the Eastern media establishment to even discuss the subject, because when that piece appeared in The New Yorker, it was really the first time anybody in the Eastern media power structure had ever even reported on the existence of the gay community. The gay civil rights movements of the movement of the 70s before AIDS is the most underreported story of our time. We've been having enormous demonstrations for years. For 10 years now, 300,000 people have been meeting in the streets of San Francisco every summer to protest what we feel are infractions against the rights of gay people, and yet the press has systematically chosen to ignore it until AIDS. And when AIDS came along, or more specifically, when Rock Hudson popularized the idea of AIDS, the press suddenly had to get its act together and figure out just exactly what they knew about the subject.
Well, in New York, when the annual gay rights parade marches up Sixth Avenue, well, even going back years, there was tremendous news coverage of it. I mean, there were 200,000 people marching up to the Sheep Meadow. So everybody was covering that. And that was when it first developed. It was so unusual to see this outpouring, this public display, that it captured a lot of attention. It also followed this police attack on a bar on Christopher Street, as I recall, which also brought a certain assertiveness in the gay community that hadn't been there before. Mm-hmm. All of these things, you talked about the civil rights issue, but it seems to me that the gay community has succeeded to a great degree in focusing a positive degree of attention on itself. Is that true?
Well, if that were true, I think we'd be getting more attention to the AIDS epidemic right now. I don't think that 5 years would have passed and 21,000 people would have died before the President of the United States could bring himself to mention the word AIDS to the American public. Well, if that were true, I think the New York Times would have discussed AIDS and this huge epidemic raging in the midst of its city long before last year or whenever they first decided to start covering the subject matter. If you talk to any epidemiologist, gay or straight, on the subject of AIDS, they will tell you that there was a virtual news blackout on the subject until the summer of 1985. And I believe that that's because that there is an underlying attitude that this is something that just involves these people who are not, as you say, natural, who are doing something they shouldn't be doing in the first place, and if they would stop doing it, they wouldn't get this terrible disease, and that simply is not the fact. It's a virus. It's that's transmitted sexually, and anybody can get it.
Well, it's unfortunate that when we think of gays now, we have to couple gays with the thought of AIDS, because it seems to me that that gays should be thought of in the same sense as anybody else. And we don't think of heterosexuals in terms of sexual diseases and this sort of thing. It's important, I think.
You don't? You don't know anybody that's ever had syphilis or gonorrhea?
No, but look, anybody can get a disease.
Exactly. So why do you have to think of gays in connection with it?
That's what I'm saying. Precisely what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That because of the...
Well, there's no question. I see what your point is, that it may have set back the whatever advances have been made as far as civil rights, and because people have such negative associations with AIDS. But all I'm saying is that there's no guilt to be assigned here. It's a virus. Gay people got it first, and it was passed around, but God knows if people knew that that was happening, they would not, you know, they would have altered their behavior. There's an enormous incubation period with AIDS, you know. I mean, I've know people that altered their behavior 5 or 6 years ago, and they're still infected with the virus. It's not as if there was irresponsible behavior going on after people learned of the virus. I mean, I'll grant you there are people today who still are acting as if there's no tomorrow, and you know, there probably will be no tomorrow for them. You know, and I spend a lot of my time trying to drive that home with straight people, trying to say, you know, you owe it to yourself to practice safe sex all the time. Don't think this is something that can't happen to you. And I'm now find that I'm saying it to heterosexuals. But we can't live with these pagan ideas of assigning guilt. I mean, how long did people go around whispering cancer because they thought there was something inherently evil about getting cancer? Or any number of the other diseases that somehow in this country we associate with some kind of moral failing?
Yeah, I recall that a number of years ago, after a death from cancer, the obituary would say died after a long illness.
Exactly, and they're doing it with AIDS now.
Well, I see more and more an openness about reporting the cause of death. And usually when you see a young person who has died, choreographer or designer, the age of 30.
Or a congressman.
Or a congressman. Now... the cause of death is usually stated, and if it happens to be AIDS, it's AIDS.
Mm.
And I noticed that talk about this openness and reporting aids and so forth. Barney Frank, I noticed, I guess it was in the newspaper this morning or earlier this week, that he announced publicly he was gay. I wonder why that has to be stated. Is it necessary for somebody to say, hey, I'm out of the closet and I'm gay and this is the way it is?
I think so. I applaud Congressman Frank a great deal over having done that. He made two statements, if you remember. He said, first of all, I'm telling you this not because I think it affects my job in any way. That's what you're saying. Why should he say it? Because what does it matter if he's a good congressman? Why should we know what his private life is? The second part of his statement was, but I'm saying this because if I didn't say it, I would be implying that I have something to be ashamed of. And I think that's absolutely true. I think that gay people, by keeping silent in that way over the years, have given the impression that they have something to be ashamed of. And as a consequence, we're all invisible. At least the famous ones are invisible. Maybe the ones that people see on the street and think of in terms of negative connotations, you know, the ones that cavorting on the street corner or whatever, are the only, many people think are the only gay people that exist, and they're not aware that gay people are everywhere, that they're in every profession, that they run networks, that they run banks, that they're prominent doctors and lawyers, they're everywhere. God help us, Jim Baker might even be one. I deny it too. I hope to God he's not.
Well, Armistead Baupin, do you have a nickname? Or is
everybody Armistead is what my Armistead friends call me, yeah.
Your name and your nickname. Well, these are wonderful stories, and it's an interesting read, and it's highly entertaining, and I can certainly recommend it, and I appreciate the fact that you took the time to come in, because I noticed your itinerary in this folder here, and it looks like you're going all across the country in a devastating tour, so I hope you recover from that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.